Blog Talk Radio.
Show. My name is Don Allen, and over in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, it's a beautiful evening out here in Minnesota, the Twin Cities.
Yes, it is, Don. Absolutely lovely. Temperature is just perfect. A little overcast in some places, but this is Minnesota beautiful, I guess.
Yeah. I guess we're going to get a little rain tomorrow morning, starting at 6 a.m., so it's going to wet things down because it's kind of needed, but, you know, be welcome. It's still nice. Just still beautiful night, though. So.
Right. Absolutely. So what do we got, Don? A lot of news. A lot of different places. Another theater shooting, by the way. Nashville, Tennessee, 51-year-old Caucasian male shot and killed after he was using both pepper spray, gunfire, and he had a hatchet. Show there. Movie theater and a strip mall there in Nashville, Tennessee. That's the second type of shooting in Nashville in the last couple of weeks. I just don't know what's happening in white America, man. We need to take a look at what's happening in the neighborhoods, in the communities, right?
Yeah, we do. And we need to get some of our leaders here in the Twin Cities for our international domestic leaders over to the Walker Art Center Sculpture Garden. You know, they're set to start a $33 million region over there, Mr. Edwards. So maybe they'll put a spoon with a strawberry in it, you know, with the cherry over there. Or we'll see what happens with that. You know, a lot of money being shuffled around here, and not a lot of people of color getting opportunities to even bid on those type of jobs.
Right.
Seems
to be, you know, kind of generating certainly towards in the Liberian community, one of our African communities here in the Twin Cities, is the Pierre Collins story, and that what appears to be tragedy. Clearly was a tragedy. I mean, his 10-year-old son, Barway Collins, is found dead, and Pierre Collins is charged with his murder. Both in the first and second degree. He's sentenced this past Monday. I hear the little one in the background there, Don. It was this past Monday to 40 years, I think, without parole in the maximum security facility here in Minnesota at a place called Oak Park Heights, if you will. And there's been a lot of back and forth, and I know you reached out today to the Reverend Harding Smith, who was for a period of time in March and, well, some of most of April, May, was a spokesperson for Pierre Collins and et cetera. And yesterday there was a press conference, if you will, and then in this morning's edition of the major newspaper here in the state of Minnesota, the Reverend Harding Smith indicates that back on the 8th of May that Pierre Collins, in a spiritual meeting, confessed the murder of his son to Pastor Harding Smith. And this has raised some pretty tough questions, legally and otherwise, to certainly the public defender's office, who was the legal representative of Mr. Collins. The county attorney, Mike Freeman, and who was prosecuting the case, later negotiated a plea bargain. The judge, an African-American judge, by the way, Tanya Bransford, who sentenced, went over the in excess of the guidelines, too, the sentencing guidelines. So I understand you've had a chance to talk to the Reverend Harding Smith. I understand he's not going to be able to be with us live, but I understand there was some kind of over the phone interview. Are we going to be able to share that with our listening audience and kind of get a feel about
Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Mr. Edwards. That interview is 3 minutes and 56 seconds, and I think that we should maybe start out by listening to that interview. How do you feel about that?
Yes, sir. Let's do that, and then we can kind of discuss what the heck has happened here and what the legal implications are.
Okay, here's the recording or interview recorded earlier, the Ron and Don Show with Reverend Harding Smith.
Link just started that out that way, that a pastor stealing money, you know, it just mushroomed into something else and went in all kinds of dark corners. Well, it started out with a lie.
Okay, and you said you went to WCCO this morning and talked to the folks, the producers?
I talked to the producer, and they said they would remove it. I just told them that, listen, no one in this community or any community can tell you they could pass a Smith $1 towards Bowery's funeral, because I did not take money for Bowery's funeral. I did not manage money. My name was not on any account. I used my own money to help facilitate some of the things I did for this boy's funeral. Not 25 cents, not a dime came through my hands. I totally disassociated myself from anything that had to do with money. So they went and posted that Pastor Harding Smith is the same pastor that was accused of mismanaging funds for Bowery Funeral. How can I mismanage funds when I never managed funds in the first place? And these are the kind of slander of a pastor. These are kind of the hatred towards people of God that we are talking about, especially black pastors. We have it hard.
Mm.
And it's rough.
Okay, and so, I mean, out of the meeting with the producers, what were they willing to do?
They told me they are going to remove the part that said that you were involved with money or you mismanaged money. But the damage is already done. The damage has already been done when the seed is planted in the mind of people that this is a crooked pastor, that this is a pastor that was somehow involved in diverting funds from a dead child funeral. This is crazy.
Yeah.
This is the worst accusation you can make against anyone.
Okay, let me ask you this. Now, yesterday you had a press conference and a couple of stations were there to cover it. Now, it's rumored that Pierre Collins did not act alone. Is that correct?
Right, this thing, what I said yesterday was the confession that Pierre Collins gave in court is a different confession that he gave back in May. And just to let the community know, when Pierre Collins did make that confession, it was not a confession that was sat on. Right there were immediate steps that were taken, which Mr. Collins agreed with, and several law enforcement agencies was contacted and brought in. So, did he act alone? You see, Pierre told me so many different stories. It's hard sometimes to separate fact from fiction. Mr. Collins told me he did not do this alone. And I trust the prosecutor. They believe they have that man, and for this healing to start in the community, we have to start somewhere. It has to be now. So from his own mouth, he stated in court that he acted alone. So I guess that's what we have to go with. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your time.
Okay.
And you have a good day. All right?
Okay. And we'll talk Wednesday.
Okay. Bye. Holy shit. Okay. Mr. Edwards, that was the interview with Reverend Harry Smith of
I lost you there for about 10 seconds. There was some kind of disconnect there. I was able to shoot back in. But I'm aware, basically, because I had listened to it earlier today. I mean, I'm not understanding. Give me a sense, Don, of your feeling, because there seems to be some real confusion here. And Pastor Harding was quoted in this morning's edition of the Napster Tribune as saying that that Pierre Collins told him that others had acted with him in the murder of his 10-year-old son, yet that's not what happened at the hearing on yesterday, if you will, mm-hmm. or you know, actually on Monday, and then it was press conference Monday. I mean, what was your professional take as you listened to the minister? Because, I mean, I heard him defending himself that he was not involved in the misappropriation of any monies, though there were articles in the Minneapolis Star Tribune which suggested that there was a serious friction and breach within the Liberian community about monies that were given for the funeral for the child, also monies to bring the birth mother here, Louise, to bring her here from Monrovia, Liberia, and et cetera. And I remember that Star Tribune, not us, but the Star Tribune ran a story in which the a grocery store owner, a very prominent Liberian grocery store owner with a facility there in Brooklyn Park, demanded his money be returned. I think it was about $2,000 because
And Mr. Edwards, we have the studio has disconnected, so I will continue this. What Mr. Edwards was talking about was a local store owner in out there in Brooklyn Center, and this is Mr. Edwards actually checking back in from his studio. Mr. Edwards. Okay. Yeah, I can hear you, but you need to switch on the top switch there. Okay, I'll stand by. So we'll be right back right after this song.
I got something in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to sing on. Let our rejoice and rise high as the lifted skies. Let it resound up loud as the roaring sea. Come on, y'all.
Sing a song full of the faintest, the darkest, the daughter.
All right, now. All right.
Sing a song full of the hope that the present is mine.
Hear, hear.
Okay, we are live back on the air. Don Allen and Mr. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, you should be able to hear me loud and clear now.
Okay, looks like we corrected whatever our technical problem was. Maybe it had to do with the what with the recording of the Reverend Smith, Harding Smith. My question to you before we began to have the technical problems was that what was your take of what is being said, particularly in light of the quotes in this morning's edition of the paper, the statement by a spokesperson for the Hennepin County prosecutor, if you will, that Mr. Harding Smith, Pastor Harding Smith, was incorrect in saying that he was told by Pierre Collins that others were involved. I mean, what are we to make of this?
I think it's very troubling that now the pastor, you know, tells us that he was retained a confession in May that he acted alone, and there's even the story on television, on the news stations, and the Star Tribune leaves huge questions about what happened. How did this happen? And from what I saw on TV, that he disciplined the son and hit him so hard that he died. And then you ask, well, where did this happen? Was this in broad daylight? Was this in the parking lot? Where did he duct tape the child's hands and legs and arms and feet together?
Yes, yeah, so these are discussions we've had in the production meeting, and in fact on my television program to air Sunday, which was taped yesterday. I, you know, raised these questions. I'm just really confused. Let me go back and give a couple of answers to a couple of the questions you have posed. Number one, the child arrived home at about 3:20 p.m. Central Standard Time. It was a bright day, a sunny day, and et cetera, and there's video showing him getting off the school bus and getting ready to go in the front door of the apartment building in which they resided in, and then him turning and looking back out towards, there's a park there just in the middle of that complex, over 100 apartments facing that complex. Now, early on, the police were saying that some of the cameras allegedly did not record
mm-hmm.
at what point that the child approached his father, which is troubling because there are cameras everywhere in that vast courtyard. But I'm like you. He said he struck him. You said that. And then
mm-hmm.
Pierre said that he struck him. The child fell to the ground and that the child was dead, you know, and so he didn't call medical attention, but or assistance. But then he, the father,
mm-hmm.
had some duct tape, had a, mm-hmm. a large garbage bag, which I'm not quite sure.
Conveniently.
Yeah. And he then duct taped him. My question then becomes, he duct taped him where? Where did this take place? It clearly could not have taken place there in the park with over 100 apartments facing that park, and it was 3:25, 3:30 at that time. Children are coming home from school. People are moving back and forth. As I said, that's a very large complex, over 400 apartments, if you will. And then the whole thing of initially we were told as the public that there were video cameras on what is called County Road 81, which showed Pierre, and they said initially, Barway, his son, riding in the car going to Cubs Supermarket, where they maintained that Pierre Collins went in and checked the ATM machine and came back out and then left from there and went to the Mississippi River, where he
mm-hmm.
then took the child and put him in the river. I mean, after putting duct tape and a sucker on him. The sequence doesn't make sense, and you know, you're talking about dead weight, if you will, if that child was both either unconscious or dead. In fact, his son Barway does not weigh as much as Pierre Collins, but he's taller than his father. In fact, he was a very developed young man, if you will. And so I'm just trying to figure out, you know, we had analyzed earlier today, Mr. Allen, you had taken a look at some a video and et cetera, and that was, number one, it'd be a long distance to take that body through the woods down the bicycle path, down to the river, and then lifted up into this very large, what is called container basin. And then we had the whole thing. What about the uncle? Remember, we were all being mesmerized by the fact that, Barway allegedly said, "There's my dad and uncle." And then the video came out, and they said he said my uncle as opposed to just uncle. Okay. That was the reason that he was questioned so intensely in those the days immediately following the police questioning him. So you know, I wonder, was there anything ever said to Pastor Harding about the uncle? What happened to the uncle?
Yeah, you know, and I didn't get a chance to ask him that question. Kind of on the move, and that's something that he did contact me about an hour ago and said that he'd be willing to come on the air next Wednesday.
Pastor Harding?
Harding says that he would be willing to come on next Wednesday, and I left it open. I said, well, I'll talk to my co-host, and I don't think it'll be a problem because we have a lot of unanswered questions. Your interview alone leaves several questions that need to be answered immediately because we might have a little bit of malfeasance in this confession that was given to the Hennepin County county attorney that he had his press conference yesterday.
Right.
The prosecutor.
Well, let me be correct to make sure that we have our listening audience still with us. Want to be sure I heard correctly. About an hour ago, Pastor Harding called you back. Now, he initially had said that he would be unable to join us because this was a Bible study. This is Wednesday, and this is Bible study. So he will forsake Bible study next Wednesday to join us? Is that
yes.
Is that what we're being
and
told?
He will join us. Yes, that's what we're
okay.
being told. And he will, join
and
us
he will answer what questions?
He said he will answer any questions that he has the answer to that we ask.
Well, I'm going to
so
ask some now so we don't have to, you know, we can utilize all the time that we would have next Wednesday if he's able to join us. Number one, I'd like to find out from Pastor Harding, did he inform on May 8th or thereabouts, May 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th, after the confession was made to him in the Hennepin County Jail because Mr. Collins had been incarcerated. Did Pastor Harding Smith share this information with Mr. Collins' attorney, who is the public defender, the Hennepin County public defender? I think that becomes an important question. And what was the decision of our public defender to also withhold that information, per se, if you will, from the courts? And from the prosecutor, the Hennepin County attorney. I mean, I think that that's a valid question because there are some legal and ethical, you just said it, Mr. Allen, there are some ethical mm-hmm. questions that then emerge, okay? So did he talk to Mr. Collins, his attorney, because Mr. Collins had legal representation by that time? And I'd be most interested in how and what the decision was based on legal precedent. That becomes a key element. What is the legal precedent in a situation in which a defendant who has been certified to stand trial, he was to stand trial in January, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Collins,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but he has confessed. And I wonder if the presiding judge, Tanya Bransford, if the judge prior to Monday and Tuesday, if she had been advised that. Because here's what happened. Beth McDonough, who is a reporter for one of the TV stations here in the Twin Cities, reported on Sunday evening that Mr. Collins was going to plead guilty to second-degree murder. So that meant certainly somebody leaked something to Channel 5, that's KSTP.
Uh-huh.
And so that then raises an additional question. Because doing the allocution, if you will, in which the law required Pierre Collins to state to the court his guilt, there seems to be no record, Mr. Allen, of Mr. Collins indicating that he had confided in his religious advisor, that would be Reverend Harding Smith, that he had committed this crime and that he had asked for forgiveness and had made that aware. Now, that then means that his attorney of record, the public defender, I assume, again, would have been cognizant of the confession by Mr. Collins. That then brings us back to Mr. Collins making a statement that he did not act alone. And I know we are getting text messages, as I understand it, and, you know, has Pastor Harding Smith called you back? Is he on the line? Is he ready to come on?
No, he said he would come on next Wednesday. He would not.
That's what I'm saying. I know he said next Wednesday, yeah.
Yes.
So these are some questions for him with regards to what happened. See, what I'm puzzled by, Mr. Allen, is that at what point, given that everybody suddenly knew that Mr. Collins was going to plead guilty, did Mr. Collins ever walk anybody through all of the events that happened on that fatal afternoon at the apartment complex and then by the river? I mean, did he talk in terms of how he knew that the child was dead after he had punched him? Did he explain how he transported the body to the shores of the Mississippi River there along Highway 94, how he put the body into the water and such things as that? You know, I mean, it would seem to me that the court would want to have that information, because you don't want an allegation by somebody who may decide to take on this particular matter, or the question is posed to the court about ineffective counsel. And I think people out there who are familiar with law know what I'm talking about, because you certainly do not want to see a situation where Mr. Collins was being served by ineffective counsel. This means attorneys that were not effective, didn't know what they were doing, didn't have the best interests of the defendant. I mean, I'm just not understanding. I think these are fair questions, Mr. Allen. I just think that these are fair questions that need to be asked.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you about that, because, you know, even just hearing, you know, just, again, folks, we're not making this up. This is Pierre Collins, spiritual guidance leader, Reverend Harding Smith, who told us in the interview that it is not the same confession he got in May, that what he confessed to in the courtroom just recently, within the last week. So he said that other people were involved, and we need to know who those other people are. Period, you know, and that will then start the community healing, and not before. I mean, right now there's way too many questions. You know, Mr. Edwards, I took an aerial view on Google Earth of that reservoir basin, that round reservoir basin, and
a big concrete of facility.
Metal
yes,
steel and concrete. And I hate to even think like this, but you know, the guy would have to carry the dead body down the bank of the river and get in the water, which was at that point deep enough to be over both of their heads, climb up in this reservoir, if that's what he did. Now,
well,
it would have to be,
except on the day that the body was found by Boy Scouts, who had been at that site before, the initial police transmission said that the body was about 10 feet away from shore, which is a fairly decent distance, but you know, at what point did the body surface? Normally, unfortunately, bodies will come to the top as decomposition takes place and there begins to be kind of air pockets in the body, and the gas that is in your body begins to seep out, and that's when you basically come to the top of the water. He had been in the water for almost a month. And the chronology is well known to everybody. Mr. Allen has just given a description which can be captured by anyone with a computer. And if you would, Mr. Allen, identify the particular link. And
not a problem. You go in and you go to Google Earth and just type in search Mississippi Regional Park, and it will give you the overview of that whole area. All the way into downtown Minneapolis, and as far as you want to look, and bring you up close and personal to the riverbanks along the North Regional Park where that particular infrastructure sits.
Now, there are a couple other questions I have, Mr. Allen, as a person who will certainly be wanting to hear Reverend Harding Smith's response. Two things. Number one, I've been asking the question within the Liberian community, if, in fact, Pierre Collins was a Christian or a Muslim. He seems to have come from a tribe in Liberia that has, and it is a tribe that is more rural than it is cosmopolitan or urban. It is also a tribe that apparently, and it is more situated in the kind of the north east corner of the nation, and it is an area that has a long history of a Muslim presence. And so I had asked the question. No one seems to be able to to clarify if he was a Christian or if he was a Muslim. Reason I asked that question, Mr. Allen, and for our listeners and et cetera, is that it seemed that things really turned against Pierre Collins when he challenged the Crystal Police Department, whose jurisdiction the Collins family lived in, and apparently, you know, where the crime was, quote unquote, committed. When Mr. Collins raised the question about an Amber Alert or the absence of an Amber Alert, and actually went with a delegation of imams, those are Muslim religious leaders, the system seemed to turn on him, and at the same time, the FBI had come in to help the Crystal Police Department as well as the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is the local investigative statewide agency here in Minnesota, had also come in. And then suddenly it seemed that Mr. Collins was being confronted as a hostile person. Then the information came out that he was a person of interest. He was then called in for a series of interviews. We were looking at a tape earlier today of an interview he did in which he talked in terms of how they came. They took his clothes, half of his clothes. They took his car. They did DNA swabs and et cetera. He said he was doing everything to cooperate. But it seemed that things really changed when the Muslim clerics went with him to the police station. Also, I'm most interested that we have heard nothing at all. And again, this can be recaptured on cyber, social media, whatever. Was the press conference in very late March at the housing complex that the family lived in, when a very large man of color wearing army fatigues confronted, I'll never forget it, it's been captured on all of the four major stations here in the Twin Cities, when he accused Pierre Collins, who was standing there with supporters and his wife, Yolanda, and et cetera, his brother had come in and flown into town, accused him of killing his son. He said at that time, why don't you confess? Why don't you tell people that you killed your son? Why don't you tell them that? Why are you standing there and going through this exercise? And it was interesting because there were a number of undercover police officers, both from the Crystal Police Department, Sheriff's Department, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I assume probably one or two FBI agents. And there was a car parked about 100 yards from where everyone was standing. And after this African-American or black gentleman wearing army fatigues made his allegations, he moved away and went to this car. And I later saw one of our ministers, in fact, I saw Reverend Harding Smith walk over to that car, and I saw a conversation, and then I saw Reverend Smith come back, if you will. And the gentleman then came back. In fact, there is a picture of him, and this is on Channel 4, 5, 9, and 11. There's a picture of him, again, pointing his finger and hollering. And, in fact, the person standing right at his right elbow is this commentator. Because I'm looking at the gentleman, and I'm trying to figure what the heck is going on. Iris Perez of Channel 9, KMSP, also at that time raised the question to Mr. Collins about the insurance. Remember the whole issue of the insurance. Now, we had two programs here on the Don and Ron program in which we invited comments and we talked about some of these issues. But the gentleman in question, who seemed to know both about the insurance and knew about the fact that Mr. Collins had allegedly killed his son, I'm not understanding that he was even on the witness list to testify at trial. Isn't that interesting? And so maybe Pastor Harding can help us identify that person. There is video, if you will. There is surveillance film of people talking to the gentleman, and there is also surveillance film of the conversation at the car in the parking lot approximately 100 yards away from where things were taking place. And so I'm just trying to figure out who in the heck this guy was. You know, and I first looked at him, I thought it was our friend K.G. Wilson, who has called in frequently on this program, and we all know, but it wasn't K.G. It was a person that was there that afternoon, never to be seen again. Now, you know, bottom line, phone lines are open, by the way. Pastor Harding says that on 8th of May, 2015, that in a prayer session at the county jail, that Pierre Collins said, I murdered my son. Now, here's the other question I have to have that I would hope that Pastor Harding can answer for us. Where specifically in the jail did that conversation take place? Was it in the regular sitting room where they were talking on the phone to each other with a you know, bulletproof windows separating them? Or did the sheriff's department provide a special room in which only Reverend Harding Smith and Pierre Collins were situated? I mean, I think, Mr. Allen, I think you agree. I mean, that becomes also imperative. I mean, where were they when this discussion took place? Because if it was on the phones, that whole call was recorded. It was in the room.
Yeah.
That conversation was recorded. And so these are just some questions for Reverend Harding Smith that will kind of enlighten us, help us understand the complexity of a guilty plea in a courtroom here in Hennepin County a couple of days ago. I mean, I just think that, you know, these are kind of fair questions, if you will. And then I know there are others out there. There's a gentleman by the name of Sese, who is the head of a Liberian Community Association, or et cetera. He had made some comments, and I know there were at least three meetings in the Liberian community where questions were raised about the monies that had been raised, both to bury the child. There's a whole thing involving the Estes Funeral Home. Hopefully Reverend Harding Smith can help us with that. And then there's the whole thing of bringing the birth mother, Louise, here from Monrovia, as well as some things that she said on a talk show program in Monrovia sometime in very late April. So there's a lot of things out there that, you know, I'm saying Don could help us understand how this thing kind of fell apart, where Pierre Collins was saying that others helped him commit this heinous, dastardly act, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And we're going to have to figure this out, Mr. Edwards, because I am going to try to get back in touch with Reverend Harding Smith and just, you know, and pass these questions by him, because this is important stuff. I mean, the media is not telling us anything. The Hennepin County prosecutor is not saying anything. And if this is the case, it opens up a can of worms that, you know, we need to sift through and figure out what's going on. Bottom line.
Absolutely. And you know, we haven't given the phone number. Let's give the phone number in case anyone wants to call in, and then we can move on to certainly other issues. But this is a burning issue in our city. 10-year-old child's life was snuffed out, if you will, and it just seems that the description of what happened on that terrible day in March just doesn't. It seems to be too cloudy for a situation in which the court should have been satisfied that there was no intimidation or collusion or et cetera in obtaining a plea of guilty to second degree murder.
I agree, and that phone number is 347-426-3904. Again, the number is 347-426-3904. 3904. The phone lines are open. Comments, concerns, questions, or a topic, give us a call.
Cool.
Yeah.
This is pretty neat, this whole thing, and just trying to figure this out.
Yes. It most certainly is, and certainly we know that our friends in the Liberian community, but even the broader community, irrespective of race, creed, color, national origin, religion, and etc., want to be assured that this was a clean legal and judiciary process. You know what I'm saying? That something else wasn't happening, because I'm very anxious to hear where that confession took place within the jail complex. Also, Reverend Harding has pointed out that he had visited Pierre Collins at least 60 times after he was incarcerated. And, 60 meetings over a period of a couple months, in fact, that's almost every day per se, right? Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
There must have been some very deep conversations. And see, the confidentiality factor no longer is in play, because it has been revealed that Pierre Collins confessed to his spiritual advisor on May 8th that he had murdered his child. So any other conversations that took place, I heard the comment in the telephone interview you did with Pastor Harding, in which he said it's now time to move towards healing and etc. I understand that, but can you heal when there are still so many questions out there about the act that took place? That's where I come down on this particular issue.
No, I'm right there with you, because we need to get these answers immediately. And someone knows something, Mr. Edwards, is just not getting out there, because I felt, when I heard that Pierre Collins had just said, hey, I'm guilty, and then I'm hearing all this other stuff, I think it was kind of a kangaroo court process, and it's a done deal.
Well, yes, and certainly in light of the fact that the district court judge, Tanya Bransford, actually went up and above the sentencing guideline under Minnesota law and sentenced him to 40 years. And by the way, I assume it's 40 years without parole, though all of a sudden I saw articles saying that he would be eligible for parole in 17 or 18 years. I'm just not quite figuring out how that's going to be when she went outside of the guidelines and sentencing him, if you will. But again, you see his attorney of record, his attorneys of record, because his attorneys are the Hennepin County Public Defender. Okay, it's not like, somebody got him a jackleg lawyer from down on the corner, in Chocolateville. Mm-hmm. These are knowledgeable, professional, expert individuals who handle these kind of cases each and every day, if you will. But I got to repeat this again, unless we have a call waiting. I'm just not understanding how the public defender's office responded when I assume at some point Reverend Harding Smith shared with them the fact that Pierre Collins had provided him with a confession, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Any calls, Don?
We're getting a few texts in, but
I bet we're getting texts. Yeah,
Okay. We do have a call now. We do have a call.
Let's get the call. We want to open the phone lines. We want to be fair and balanced. So yes, caller, go ahead.
Sorry, you live on air.
Gentlemen, how you guys tonight? This is
real good, Brother Nelson. What's your observation? What's your thinking?
Man, first of all, hell would be too good for Pierre.
Mm-hmm.
He's a sick, sadistic fool. And again, I think hell would just be just a really too gracious of a place for him.
Okay, let me ask you this.
I understand,
because people are saying that about him, that he's a devil and a parasite, etc. Do you think that he acted alone?
I do not think that he acted alone. I think that for once in his life he's trying to have a little bit of humility and not turn in the person that helped him commit this heinous crime. But no, I don't think that he acted alone. What's scary is the fact that my mother lives about two blocks away from where he in his son's life. And it's scary because we could, my wife and I think all the time about we could have been there, probably was at home when he drove past either our house or my mother's house to end this child's life. You know,
well, wait a minute. Let's be clear for our audience. Now, he indicated in the court document that he ended the child's life right there in the apartment complex.
Right, knocking him when he knocked him out.
Not when he dumped him into the water. You
right,
have to
when
read
he knocked him out.
The stories and the transcript. So his life ended right there in the courtyard with over 100 apartments facing where the punch was delivered, where Barway fell and where Barway died. If you are to believe and accept what statements were made by Pierre Collins in a courtroom in Hennepin County. So I just think it's fair that we clarify where Barway allegedly died.
Well, and you're right to do that. We should be just as transparent as he hasn't been. But I personally don't believe that. I think that young man was knocked out unconscious. And he bound this young man and threw him in the water, and that's where the young man's life ended because he drowned. I think the pastor is in a between a rock and a hard place. I mean, here he is doing his biblical clerical duty, to Pierre, and then at the same time he's got church members and he's got outside community members telling him that he should not be counseling him. So I think that he's in a damned if you do, damned if you doesn't situation. But I think
right,
he's doing the right thing
because this is a good discussion. Should the pastor have stayed quiet then? Should he have carried this to his own grave?
He should not have. I think that, I don't know. I do know that, something that you are supposed to have a confession and it's supposed to be like an attorney-client situation. But I think that he was compelled by God and also by his clerical duties too. What happened was he wholeheartedly believed in what Pierre said at first. And I think that it shocked him. I think that his humanity came into play. Totally into fruition when he was told that he ended this young man's life. I think that he believed Pierre did not have anything to do with it. And it shocked him. And so he went against probably his clerical duty, but I think that he did the absolutely right thing to go to the police with what he knew to convince the... Now, correct me if I'm wrong, even if you tell your attorney that you commit murder... Your attorney is supposed to keep that quiet as well, too, correct?
Well, let me say this. I mean, you're correct on that. But are you saying that Pastor Harding Smith has the same standing as an attorney and a physician of medicine as pertains
well,
to confidentiality?
Does. No doubt he does. He absolutely does. Mm. But I think that human nature compelled him to go. They are tribal people. They do a little. They do things differently than other cultures do. So I think that if you watch the news and seen the articles, the whole community said, no, Liberians don't do this. We don't kill our own. And so I think that they were absolutely shocked. And then who couldn't be shocked and have
well,
a heart?
Let me just say this, though, Brother Nelson. I understand what you're saying, but our role here is to counterbalance. The statement about Liberians saying that they don't do that, I mean, that's just not true. One has to just familiarize himself with the 10-year Liberian Civil War. There were some terrible atrocities and et cetera. So I can't accept that balances it out. But I want to come back to, but why now? Why now? You've known since May 8th. You were shocked then, though you continue to visit and to counsel, if you will, and you were very much aware of the negotiations that went on over the weekend. I'm talking about Reverend Harding Smith.
Right.
That went
right.
on over the weekend in which the plea bargain was worked out. But why then bother to tell the secret? Or do you feel that he needed to do that, Reverend Harding Smith needed to do that to put his own conscience at rest or at peace?
Two things. I think, in a sense, yes, he was trying to ease his own conscience. But looking at that cheap suit that he had on in the interview the other day, I also think that this is a guy that was looking for a bit of fame, so to speak. I don't think that he needed the media, the news media, to be in front of them to say that he was that he knew that Pierre had committed these type of heinous crimes. So a lot of this probably was showmanship on the pastor's part, but I guess I'm willing to overlook that part of him being selfish because of the fact that he did eventually tell it. And so, I guess you got to look over the little silly thing.
Okay. Let's ask a couple questions now because we have you with us. If we have other phone calls holding, Mr. Allen, please interrupt me, and we'll thank Brother Nelson.
Yeah, we have one caller holding.
All right, ask them to hold because I have this question of Mr. Nelson and his observations and et cetera. Based on during the course of his allocation and et cetera, where do you think that the child was actually killed? I mean, you say that you feel that he died as he was being put in the water. By the way, there is a forensic impossibility to determine the cause of death. That's why the coroner could not determine the cause of death because the body had been in the water for almost a month. So they don't know if he drowned or et cetera because the body was that decomposed. Where do you think, sir? I just want to get a reading and for other listeners that are out there and want to call in and question what our theory, and certainly my theory, I can't speak for my colleague, Mr. Allen. Where do you think the punch took place? Where do you think they were when the father knocked his son out? Where do you think they were?
I do believe that the kid was at home because if you think about from the time that the video showed him being
up the bus. I have to cut you off, bro. I mean, I have to do it this way. When you say at home, do you mean in the apartment?
In the apartment. I think that he was knocked unconscious.
Well, now, let me,
in
the reason
apartment.
I asked that question is kind of a trick question, because if he was in the apartment, then that makes his stepmother an accessory, because she was in the apartment.
Look, absolutely she should have been charged with something. The moment she was arrested, absolutely knew of the heinous crime. She absolutely played a part in a pivotal role in this young man's death and should be charged with
at least accessory. Do you think that's who Pierre Collins was talking about to Reverend Harding Smith, that it was his current wife, the woman that he was living with, that she was the person that helped him to carry out this crime? Wow.
Now that you make me think about it, I absolutely do believe that it was the wife. I mean, look, there was no uncle. Remember, he said, the young man said there was an uncle. We know that spirit was blown out of the water. There was no other man around or there waiting, says the bus driver. Okay, so I am under the impression that the mother was inside waiting, and I do believe that she knows, because to me she seems a bit submissive. She was standing at Pierre's side the whole time. She only spoke when Pierre told her to speak. So I don't know if that's a culture submission, but I believe it's a guilt submission, the fact that she was a part of this heinous crime, and maybe her conscience is getting the best of her, but if she does not be charged with a crime, that in itself is another travesty, and so what's the name, Mike Freeman should also have his head examined if he doesn't want to indict her on any charges.
All right. Mr. Allen, leave it in you because we have somebody holding. We want to, don't want to disrespect him. We hope you're still with. Do you have any questions of Brother Nelson?
No, I'm just going to put him back in the queue and then we'll go from there.
All right. Thank
Appreciate
you, Brother
that.
Nelson. Appreciate
Thanks.
Your call, man. All right. Caller, can we get that second caller? And the phone lines are open.
Yes,
interesting observation by Mr. Nelson.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead, please.
Gentlemen, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Welcome.
Okay, I'm going to identify myself. I'm Mr. M. I've been listening to your program. I had another situation I want to talk about, but I won't do that now because I think you guys are kind of, trying to inform the community and trying to process this, terrible.
No,
situation.
But don't. If you have something of importance that was on your mind, you go right ahead and bring it forward. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. Go right ahead, my brother.
Okay. Well, I guess just to kind of wrap that one up. I listening to the last caller. I really don't think that the wife you know, was really in on this type of a thing. I mean, I know there was something about an uncle and some, but it really looked like this individual was really a desperate individual and someone mm-hmm. that had, you know, kind of burned his bridges in a lot of areas mm-hmm. and kind of had a thing where he just, unfortunately, I mean, this is, you know, there's always a better way out than what he chose. So
okay, okay. All right, but go ahead. The other issue that you had.
Well, the other issue that I had is I received something in the mail the other day from, you know, it was a lady, I don't know if you know the name, Elizabeth Glidden.
Yes, she a councilwoman from the 8th Ward, Democrat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what the crux of it was that they what they've done is they've designated some houses in South Minneapolis to be, oh, I don't know, commemorated, okay, in the South Minneapolis area. And this is an area between, like, oh, 38th Street and 46th Street.
Oh, okay.
It is. There was a builder by the name of Edward Tilson who bought a bunch of lots. In that, actually, he worked with an individual who owned the lots. The person that owned 63 lots in that area was
wow.
owner of the St. Paul, the Minneapolis Millers, okay? And he bought
oh, okay,
it.
Back in the day. The Minneapolis Millers were the Triple A minor league team here until we got the Minnesota Twins in
right.
1961. Got gotcha. You. Okay.
And so we had these 63 lots in South Minneapolis. And so he connected with, he sold the lots to a builder, Mr. Ed Tilson, who built a bunch of houses on this area that all look alike in this area. And so he worked with a gentleman by the name of Archie Gibbons Sr., who was a real.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that Gibbons name is so prominent in many things. I'll let Mr. Edwards, you know, fill
yes,
in.
Yes, all the yes.
But,
first owned a drugstore in North Minneapolis at the corner of
yeah.
Olsen Highway and Lindale in the
yeah.
early
yeah,
1940s. I'm talking about 45, 46, 47, 48. Later became a commissioner of the Minneapolis Housing
Big
Authority and began to make
nursing.
A lot of money as the gentrification and highway came through North Minneapolis and
yeah,
the
well,
black commercial district disappeared. But, yes, certainly his name is well-known, as well as his, the rest
and
of
I
his family. Yes.
Meeting. The meeting was held at St. Peter's AME Church,
uh-huh.
and she invited a lot of community members, and she sent a letter out that named all these houses that were part of the Tilson Home Project. Okay?
Hmm.
And along with this, you know, they had kind of some research. I mean, they had a University of Minnesota PhD professor there
mm-hmm.
whose job is to deal with the history of the neighborhoods and what have you, okay?
Okay.
And so, first of all, I went because my son now owns one of those Tilson-built homes.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay, so I went to the meeting. My son went. His grandfather went. My wife went. We sat and we talked to him. But it was really interesting from the standpoint of they actually had a few historical documents about this neighborhood. And some of these things say statements like real estate companies were culpable in steering people in the segregated neighborhoods. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In 1946, the Minnesota Tribune reported that they wouldn't allow a Japanese buyer to buy a lot in this area. And so the agent says in the paper, although he sympathized with members of the minority groups, most real estate companies follow the general policy of restricting subdivisions to members of the Caucasian race in order to get good resale value. Okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, and I listen to this, I'm like, well, wow, this is a conspiracy. I mean, it seemed like a plan to buy these houses or buy these lots and areas back at that time and only allow black people to buy in this area, okay? You can't
yep.
buy outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
You can only buy here. And so as I listened to this, I kept trying to figure out what the point of, you know, honoring, basically what it is a segregationist type of approach. But their bent on it was that by doing these houses for blacks, they were being open, that they were being
transparent.
Accommodating.
Yeah, transparent. Mm-hmm.
They're being transparent.
Yeah.
But what they were saying and what I was hearing was not the same thing. And so we had the meetings, and there were some long-time people in the, you know, neighbors that had been here way before the Tilson Homes even. You know, there people had lived out here. Even though they weren't wanted out here, they were able to come up with the money. And another thing they talked about, the mechanisms for buying homes, even the builder said, well, we found some people that, you know, the banks wouldn't give them loans.
Okay.
So we just did a contract for deed. If they had a job and they had money to put down a down payment, we went ahead and we sold them houses, you know.
Okay.
And I look at the price, the houses were about $12,000, and you had to have $1,000 down payment. You know, and I look at how things are today, you know, my son, his first house, bought that Tilson house. Well, he had to have $20,000 down for, I mean, the opportunity just continues to shift in my mind, you know. And as I, you know, also when I went through that, I thought about the Minneapolis that I lived in at that time. Because I lived, my grandmother moved in that area, 39th and 3rd, in 1956.
Okay.
So I know all about that area and know about it, but I also remember that there were schools that everybody could walk to in their neighborhood.
Right.
Everybody had a school that they could get to, that they could walk to, and a junior high school they could walk to.
Bancroft, Bryant.
Warrington.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody had a school. So, and then I keep looking at all of these things, and as I put it together, you know, the older I get, you know, I'm thinking a lot more logical. Somebody tells me something that's stupid, it's stupid, okay? I mean, that's just the way it is. But, I mean, what a denial. I mean, when I went to high school and played football at Washburn, there was 11 high schools.
In the city, that's correct.
Now there's 5 or 6. You have a bunch of little type of schools that are for incorrigibles, that are for
charter,
you know,
schools, alternative schools. Yeah,
go here or you go, which is really just say stay out of trouble and you can be out. It doesn't say go ahead and excel academically. It doesn't offer anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to put all this together, and it it paints this picture of this ongoing and constant flowing, I mean, discrimination. Constant. You know, now, but this education one is really huge because, like I say, when I grew up, I knew all the people in the neighborhood. Almost all the people I graduated from high school with went to college.
Mm-hmm.
There's a high number, and if they didn't, they went to Ford, they went to the post office, they went to the Army. They had alternatives to the street. And I see this now, and I don't know. Maybe Mr. Edwards, maybe you can chime in. Maybe I'm all off base on all of this.
No, what you're talking about is a pattern of segregation, gentrification, and control of the population, if you will. I remember the owner of Pepito's, who I've known for many, 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 many years. We grew up together in North Minneapolis, but I remember him doing a historical piece that had been lost about some events that took place in the 1920s when an African-American family made the mistake of moving south of 38th Street. And there were riots, the governor almost had to call out the National Guard, and finally the family was paid to move back on the other side of where they belong, kind of thing. And, you know, Joe did a heck of a job. In fact, I think it was a couple summers ago, he had a series of events. He used the movie theater that he owns there on Chicago to kind of make people understand the history of a courageous African-American family that just wanted to live in a nice home, if you will, in the 1920s, and how this city responded. But I grew up at the same time knowing that, in fact, as late as 1958-59, and Mr. Allen's family grew up in that area, they would not sell a house to an African-American south of 38th, with the exception of the small black enclave over on Snelling. area of 37th and 36th and 38th and Snelling around St. James Church. African Americans couldn't, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. So we've seen that, and there doesn't seem to be the historical perspective that is so important to us to educate those that are coming behind us. Mr. Allen and I oftentimes talk about this because there's really no history. I'm surprised that they were bold enough to bring out a newspaper article from the Minneapolis Tribune, 1946, because you got to remember, you know, Willie was just coming back from fighting war, just like, you know, little Tommy, the white boy. And these were very delicate times because African Americans,
right,
Negroes, how we refer to, were asking for their place at the table. But I've seen this happen. I know that you have also. And yet there was, you know, gentlemen, there was never any penalty for this kind of activity and both personal and institutional racism. So.
See,
but what was the
point.
Final, what was the conclusion? I mean, what was the position of Councilwoman Glidden?
Mr. Edwards, it went just as all those meetings do. We need to get together again.
Okay, you're right.
We need to start the dialogue, you know.
Yeah.
And so one of the ladies, she just got up and said at the end, you know, what is the point of all this? What are y'all trying to get out of this?
Yeah.
What? And she said, well, that's a good question. And she continued to dance around it and said, well, we want you all to tell us, blah, 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 you know.
Well, you know, one of the things would help Elizabeth Glidden needs to understand this, that would help maybe that be something relevant, is if we had black people in positions of authority and policy in the planning department, booth.
Yeah.
With the exception of one person who is given the position of heading up the Minneapolis Development Agency, we don't have a lot of African Americans working in those positions in which the design of policy is developed and created, and et cetera. So maybe somebody could help Councilwoman Glidden out if they were to. Oops, that's right. She got $100,000 to do a diversity study, right, Mr. Allen?
Yes.
And the report was never issued. $100,000 2 years ago to do a diversity study, an equity study for the city of Minneapolis and get more jobs for the colored people. And it never happened. There's never been a report. So she's kind of answered her own question. You know, maybe we would, you know, she could get a better feel if she had people of the African-American persuasion working in some of these jobs.
Yeah, and I didn't see anybody in that from this, you know, from the community, really part of her pony show that she had up there, but there was another. There's one other thing I want to bring up, as you mentioned, going back as far as the 20s, you know, they had a little blurb that they sent out, and they referenced. I'm gonna read you this just real briefly.
Mm-hmm.
In Minneapolis, Milton Shanks. I think this is the person you were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
A pioneer African-American contractor built home from blacks. No, he's talking about this other one. A black farming family from Hutchinson, Minnesota, owned the successful Warmley's grocery store and a private home in South Minneapolis. Scattered throughout the area were little homes in the 20s owned by blacks. This thing goes on to say statistics show that some African-American housing that was owned was decidedly better than housing occupied by some white persons in the city. The same white.
You're right.
And so what was happening is some of these whites defied the common practice at the time and sold their homes to blacks. In 1927, a recent widow owned a one-year-old house on 40th and Clinton, an all-white block, agreed to sell her home to a black couple, Robert and Eva Mallory.
There you go. Right.
And so when I look at,
raising
you know,
those funds,
you know,
thank you.
Commemorating, you know, when I used to go, when I went to college in 1968, graduated from Washburn High School, my grandmother took me down there and dropped me off, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But every time you went and got off on that exit, you saw this statue that where 38 Indians were hung, okay?
Down in Mankato? Yep.
In Mankato. Every time you got off that exit on 169 to head get into downtown Mankato, you saw that.
Mm-hmm.
They only took it down recently. But, I mean,
mm-hmm.
how do you, I mean, I think it's, on the one hand, I think it's important that we know this is inhumanity that has gone on. But, I mean, I don't know, commemorating or, I mean, I think we should call it what it is. It's an atrocity. I mean, I think the fact that these homes were, you know, people wouldn't sell to blacks, people wouldn't, why are you even talking like that?
Yeah.
Why won't they sell to blacks? We live in this country. We pay taxes. We're under
right.
the same constitution you are. This doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense. Call the police then. You're not going to treat me right.
Yeah, yeah.
Racism.
Now, this is part of what it was. It's a long history, it's part of what Mr. Allen and I have talked about, that unfortunately, because we don't have a Black History Museum, basically our people don't have a platform in which this kind of information and the materials and et cetera that go along with the information, you know, because you certainly are not going to get the Minnesota Historical Society, right, Mr. Allen, to set aside a half a floor for African Americans and half a floor for Native Americans. And in fact, you know, of course, Native Americans were the first residents of this state. Oops. I appreciate it. And you've done some reflecting, and it's certainly more than food for thought. You know, maybe we'll get a couple callers in.
One other question before I go, mm-hmm. you know, and I appreciate the time. But isn't there something at the University of Minnesota, something called a Gibbons Collection?
Well, I don't think it's there anymore. It was
that,
a combination of some books and artifacts, some of which were taken from African-American or Negro homes during the redevelopment period when the freeway came through North Minneapolis and and particularly on the south side of Olson Highway, there were Negro homes, and people were forced out of them, if you will, and there was artifacts there that people left behind. And ultimately, that kind of became the Gibbons Collection, and the collection was on loan to the University of Minnesota. I don't know if it's still on loan. You would have to ask the curator.
Well, it's funny you say that, because the curator, if it's Archie Gibbons Jr., he was at this meeting.
How was he?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he discussed with me some publications, but I you know, so I didn't know if this thing was still going on. I'm supposed to go over there and see, but I don't know.
Well, when I say curator, though, I'm talking about the curator for the University of Minnesota's Department of History and Museum.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that'd be a good question. And you certainly gave us some food for thought. I think Mr. Allen now will kind of make inquiry and find out what kind of black collections, quote-unquote, and displays are currently at the University of Minnesota. Maybe we can go over and look and, you know, maybe we can find a display dealing with the first surveyor of the later to become known as the Minnesota Territory, a black man by the name of Bongo. Oops.
Yeah, George Bongo. Yeah.
That's right.
And Mr. Eric, before we let him go, I just would like to add in there, I think it's a dirty, rotten thing of shame that these clowns let the museum go by the wayside, put the building in foreclosure, because, again, you know, this week or last week, you know, we lost a hero here, Wallace Collier, war veteran, boxer, teacher, was a legend in North Minneapolis.
Sure.
You know, and we don't have anywhere to immortalize this black man, you know, in town.
Absolutely.
And these people just turning their nose up at it, and they just want to answer questions. So it's time to come hard after those folks. And I hope
by the way, Mr. Collier served in both the First World War, the Second World War, and the Korean conflict. Can you believe that, gentlemen?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just passed over at the – I think
he helped many students at North High School, okay?
That's right. I think Mr. Collier was 95 when he passed. Yeah. All right, Em. Thank you, sir. All right.
All right.
All right. Mr. Allen, if we've got some calls holding, the phones are still open – the caller raised some interesting questions about the pattern of redlining, because that's what we used to just call it, you know, back in the days when there were uprisings. And in this city.
Oh,
it was just good old-fashioned redlining. You know, black folks just redlined out of where they could be and where they couldn't be.
Well, you know, the evolution of redlining is now weblining in areas like Little Earth in Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, and in areas in St. Paul where they don't get the sufficient amount of web coverage or internet service or Wi-Fi service. That's a common practice in poor neighborhoods for especially poor minority neighborhoods in all across the United States. And Susan Andrews is calling this weblining.
Weblining, that's an interesting term. But yes, I would consider it to be appropriate. I know that there have been some of y'all who are very much involved with cyber and things such as that, the cyber industry, who have been raising that question. There doesn't seem to be any governmental plan. Maybe our congressman in the 5th Congressional District and maybe the congresswoman in the 4th Congressional District, which is St. Paul, maybe they can start requiring whoever the statutory agencies are to start looking at that, because that's really interesting, because what you're really doing is suppressing the inability of a specific population and group of people to have access to information.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and it just raises the question on, you know, with so much technology that we appear to have and accessing, and people got all kinds of different phones now. I'm just old-fashioned colored man. I just can't even keep up with what that is. Mr. Allen, I want to take this time to indicate the NAACP is preparing for their annual gala. They're looking at a whole host of speakers, and they had their monthly meeting yesterday, and man, they've got a lot of committees at work. I know you are a card carrying member. Did you attend the meeting last night in North Carolina?
No, it was National Night Out. I went and did something else.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, NAACP and Black Lives Matter are working very closely with the city attorney, Susan Siegel, who is, of course, a candidate for the vacancy that will take place on the state Supreme Court. And they have been meeting and talking in terms of working with the NAACP and Black Lives Matter and the Black Liberation Group. I'm not quite sure. That's a new group that's kind of emerged, if you will. Remember, they were the group that had the American flag and burn it downtown there a couple months ago. But anyways, NAACP is preparing for a number of specific issues that they're going to be addressing. And so, you know, we want to make sure we stay on top of that. One of the committees they have, Mr. Allen, you as a member of the NAACP may want to join, and that's the Cultural and Arts Committee. Are you aware of that committee? Are you still there, Mr. Allen?
Yes, I am here. I'm not aware of that committee.
Oh, okay. Yeah, are you aware of the Cultural and Arts Committee? I know they must be texting you messages. But yes, this was in the report, and I was studying the minutes of the group. And it looks like that the NAACP will be used to attempt to revitalize, I guess that's the proper word, revitalize the African American Black History Museum.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So people may, who are, you know, into the arts and the culture and et cetera, may want to join that committee because they're trying to put something together. In fact, the longtime member Barbara Bierman is one of the members of the committee. that's kind of interesting. But things are moving, if you will. The committee has met on June 16th and July 20th, and they have some members, if you will. Lessa Jones, you remember Lessa Jones? I think she's still the executive director of the African American Black Museum. She's the administrator, isn't she?
I think she was the executive director, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, 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 yes. So they are meeting, and They will be having a meeting on August 17th. I won't indicate the private home. I don't think that's appropriate because it is a private home that they will be having a meeting. And, of course, when you have something at a private home, you can definitely call the police and trespass a person if you don't want them there. Oops. But anyways, the Arts and Cultural Committee of the NAACP is fully engaged. By the way, let me read very quickly, Mr. Allen, in case we don't have any calls. These are the now standing committees of the NAACP of Minneapolis. The Criminal Justice Committee, Arts and Culture, Civic Engagement, Health and Housing, Communication and Events, Legal Support. Oh, let me do this. Let me give this phone number over the air. This is the new Legal Support Committee, which will handle all matters pertaining to conflict with the Minneapolis Police Department. The telephone number is 612-314-6150. And this is being sponsored by our, a number of major white law firms. We also then have the Labor and Economics Committee, the Education Committee, the Freedom Fund Dinner Committee, the Youth Committee, Women of the NAACP Committee, and we now have a Prison Outreach Committee. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah, we just wanted to bring the general public up to speed. A lot of committees, they're going to be engaged in a lot of specific actions. I think it's just important that folks know that. Let me also do this. We don't have any calls coming in, so our purpose is to update. Oh, we have a call?
No, we don't. Go right ahead.
Oh, okay. A lot of intensity going on in the city right now as it pertains to the death of a white female activist in North Minneapolis a number of weeks ago. A lot of volatility, more than people want to talk about, if you will. Allegations being made that black leadership is hiding the perpetrator, and I think that's some pretty dangerous stuff, and that the African American community and leadership knows who the identity of the perpetrator is, and yet are not attempting to turn the person over or identify the person to the authorities. So, you know, we want to be responsible, Mr. Allen, and indicate that. We certainly are not a part of a group that is in favor of that kind of conduct. You know, if you have knowledge of a person that has committed a heinous crime and murder and et cetera, then, you know, you should certainly work to, first of all, have that person surrender themselves and also make that person's identity known to the authority. You shouldn't have that kind of person on the streets. But it is something everybody's trying to keep a lid on, if you will. But it is intense right now, and, you know, folks need to kind of be cautious. One other thing on this end, Mr. Allen, that I had promised some people, in light of the death of a young African-American in St. Paul, who allegedly was involved in an attempted stick-up and was confronted by a Caucasian who had a permit to carry, if you will, and was then shot to death. You need to be very much on the alert for the new legislation that just passed, in which now one can, without any real depth examination by the suppressors. We used to know them in the old days as silencers, right?
Yeah.
The suppressors are being sold in record numbers at gun stores and et cetera throughout the state of Minnesota and here in the Twin Cities. And some people refer to them as a Negro muffler.
Oh, wow.
I heard that conversation among some of the folks that belong to these gun clubs and et cetera. A Negro muffler. The suppressors that you use to put on your gun. And it muffles the sound of shots being fired, if you will. Just a heads up to a lot of black folks, a lot of Caucasians, a lot of white folks in this state are, you know, making application in record numbers for permits to carry and conceal. I'm sorry, permits to carry and conceal. So I just think I feel obligated in the last 3 minutes we have that we need to just alert people that this is going on. A lot of people packing, if you will, and not all of them, quote unquote, are black criminals. All right,
wow.
Mr. Elman, anything
this
else?
Incredible.
No one, anybody in the queue want to give us a shout out or what?
We don't have anybody in the queue. It's pretty quiet in the queue right now. Well, there's a couple people, but that's it. No one wants to say anything. I was going to an asking people, tell them we got the last couple minutes here. They didn't want to say anything, and no one, they said no, so we'll just leave them at that.
Okay. Well, we, like I said, our responsibility, of course, here on the Don and Ron Show is to keep as much information flowing, if you will. That certainly has to do with the best interests and the safety of our community. By the way, construction continues on the Viking Stadium. and I assume that there must be a record number of African Americans working on the stadium, right?
I haven't seen
it. I drive by there a couple times. Yeah, I haven't either. All right, Don. No, you want to wrap it up. I want to wrap it up. We appreciate our listening audience, and we're looking forward because as I understand what you said is that the Reverend Harding Smith will be with us next Wednesday night to continue to give us more in-depth and clarification, right?
That's it. Yes, sir.
We look forward to hearing from him. All right, man. Little James Brown, take us home.
Bad now.